all scum and a mile wide. Audiences gasp at the sight of an ironing board on a London stage. How's that for an opener? How's that for a couple of takeaways? Those two remarks were responses to the play that opened at the Royal Court Theatre on this day, May 8th, in 1956. Yes, John Osborne's Look Back in Anger. Osborne was a 26-year-old jobbing actor at the time. Look Back in Anger was the play that established him as the original angry young man, and into the bargain started a vogue for kitchen sink drama. All Scum and a Mile Wide was in fact a big thumbs up from the avant-garde critic Kenneth Tynan. Writing in The Observer, Tynan said, "I doubt if I could love anyone who did not wish to see Look Back in Anger. It is the best young play of its decade." Tynan said Look Back in Anger spoke for everyone in the country between 20 and 30 years old. He said, "It presents post-war youth as it really is, with special emphasis on the non-U, non-university intelligentsia, who live in bedsitters. All the qualities are there, qualities one had despaired of ever seeing on the stage. The drift towards anarchy, the instinctive leftishness, the automatic rejection of official attitudes, the surrealist sense of humor, the casual promiscuity, the sense of lacking a crusade worth fighting for, and underlying all these, the determination that no one who dies shall go unmourned." And as for the deep shock of that ironing board on the London stage, well, what would you expect? Audiences had had a lifetime of glamorous high society, country house and Belgravia townhouse locations, and suddenly they were thrust into a pokey attic room in the Midlands. So much for the comfort zone of the better sort of people. So much for upper-class English drawing rooms and cocktails and clipped intonation. So much for restraint and understatement and the narrow bandwidth of what was acceptable to polite company. Osborne and his fellow angry young men took a blowtorch to all of that. In the words of critic Dan Rebellato, what was exquisite in the work of playwright Terence Rattigan, for example, was the use of understatement, subtext, the unsaid. There is very little unsaid in Look Back in Anger. Jimmy Porter lashes out verbally at a huge variety of topics. The class system, American evangelists, Allison's family, women in general, flamboyant homosexuals, church bells, Sundays, and more. And the tone is unstrained, scornful, witty, ferociously articulate. Osborne called them arias, like a solo in an opera. And each time Jimmy Porter launches another verbal barrage into the room, one can sense even now the power of this new music on the London stage. Osborne, Look Back in Anger, the Royal Court, the Times, what the country had been through in the preceding 20 years or so, it was the dramatic equivalent of a perfect storm. The English theatrical equivalent of the first performance of The Rite of Spring. It's a rich, rewarding field to till. But today, being May 8th, I've got other fish to fry. All Scum and a Mile Wide was our first glimpse of John Osborne and Look Back in Anger. Let's take our leave of him with a couple, well, three actually, stepping stones across that mile-wide stretch of scum. All of them pretty memorable stepping stones. They get our angry young man and his fulminations, his work, into focus. First one's well and truly biographical. As a youngster, John Osborne was expelled from his school for thumping the headmaster who'd struck him for listening to a proscribed broadcast by, Frank Sinatra. Stepping stone number two, in the words of another critic, that mile-wide expanse of scum was a pained, painful, and violently funny play that returned invective to the English stage for the first time since George Bernard Shaw and placed it in the mouth of a sadist who was also a romantic and patriot manque. "There aren't any good brave causes left," cries Jimmy Porter bitterly in the third act of the play. "If the Big Bang does come and we all get killed off, it won't be in aid of the old-fashioned grand design. It'll just be for the brave new nothing very much thank you, about as pointless and inglorious as stepping in front of a bus." And with look back in anger, John Osborne was just getting started. He also had other fish to fry. He was the first playwright to question the point of the monarchy on a prominent public stage and to treat male homosexuality, a criminal condition at the time, as a subject about which it was possible to be at once sympathetic, bracing, and lewd. In the words of biographer Michael Ratcliffe, he ran up the black flag for contempt as an honest and healthy emotion and for the purgative wisdom of bad behavior and bad taste. The real revelation was that a character could behave like a rat and still speak the truth. Okay, let's move on. Where I grew up, in the Driftless Hills of the land of the gathering waters. The Driftless Hills is the name for a region in southwestern Wisconsin. And Wisconsin itself is an Ojibwe word that means the land of the gathering waters. Anyway, I grew up on a regular diet of double features and double headers. Double features were two movies, one after the other, on the same afternoon or evening, for the price of one admission. Double headers were two baseball games in the same stadium on the same day. So this podcast, it's being May 8th, is a double header, or a double feature, if you prefer. It's May 8th, 1945. It's Victory in Europe Day. I sometimes give it a nod on my old Westminster walk. I talk about St. Margaret's Westminster, the parish church of the House of Commons, tucked in there next to Westminster Abbey, like a little lamb next to its ewe. And I say that on VE Day, after a session in the House of Commons, they all trooped over to St. Margaret's for a Thanksgiving service. But let's hear from somebody who was alive and in London on VE Day. Let's hear from Noel Coward. Here's his diary entry for May 8th, 1945. Victory Europe Day, London. A wonderful day from every point of view. Went wandering through the crowds in the hot sunshine. Everyone was good-humored and cheerful. In the afternoon, the Prime Minister made a magnificent speech, simple and without boastfulness, but full of deep pride. In the evening, I went along to the theater and had a drink with the company. We all had cold food and drinks at Winnie's. We listened to the King's broadcast and then to Eisenhower, Monty, and Alexander. Then I walked down the Mall and stood outside Buckingham Palace, which was floodlit. The crowd was stupendous. The King and Queen came out on the balcony, looking enchanting. We all roared ourselves hoarse. After that, I went to Chip Channon's open house party, which wasn't up to much. Walked home with Ivor. I suppose this is the greatest day in our history.
And for a Today in London recommendation, well, you know what's coming. How do you go wrong with a show at the Royal Court? 66 years on, it's still in the front lines, still carrying the torch of putting on new, challenging, groundbreaking work. The five titles in the current season, all by themselves, are like shark fins knifing through the water. Here they are. Two Palestinians go dogging. This is not a pity memoir. Outside edge performance. That is not who I am. And Hangman on Broadway. You've been listening to the Today in London History podcast, emanating from www.walks.com, home of London Walks, London's multi-award-winning walking tour company. Indeed, London's only award-winning walking tour company. Our secret recipe? It's no secret. It all comes down to the guiding, the caliber of the guiding. You can rest assured, guiding for London Walks is not a summer job done by high school or college students. It's not paint-by-numbers guiding. You will not be guided by a callow youth who's memorized a script. You will be guided by accomplished professionals, barristers, doctors, Museum of London archaeologists, University of London geologists, Royal Shakespeare Company actors, historians, distinguished academics, elite Blue Badge City of London and Westminster guides, professionally qualified guides who've won the big one, the MVP award, the Guide of the Year award, the creme de la creme, the maestros, well-connected, experienced, savvy, assured guides, guides who make the new familiar and the familiar new. It's elementary, my dear Watson. A top-flight guide is worth every penny. A mediocre guide is time and money wasted. The time wasted is, of course, compounded by the opportunity cost. And on that caveat emptor note, good night from London. See you tomorrow.